As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Hello, I'm Dan Bardell.
And I'm Flo Lloyd-Hughes.
And welcome to the Athletic Football Podcast, where every Wednesday we pick out one article from the brilliant writing available on The Athletic and put the authors under the spotlight.
We've had it the last couple of minutes. A statement leading European football clubs announce new Super League.
This is, for me, a war on football. And it goes against everything that football's about. It's a closed shop for these big wigs. And it's completely and utterly only about one thing, and that's money.
There are fans who have made their way into the ground. They're now heading out onto the pitch to let their feelings be known.
I think all football fans should unite today behind what Manchester United fans have done. Because honestly, what they did 2 weeks ago was really dangerous for English football. We must not forget that.
Today, our focus is on an article by The Athletic's Jack Pitbrook and a host of other Athletic contributors, and it looks into the collapse of the Super League and, more importantly, what it might look like when it comes back.
Yep, and we'll continue to celebrate Black History Month. We'll tell you a little bit about a fascinating interview on the site right now with Brandy Heron, who's the daughter of musician Gil Scott Heron and granddaughter of the first black footballer to represent Celtic. Of course, it's Gil Heron.
And we'll say hello to Jack in just a minute. But first, Dan, I want to talk about that game on Sunday. The only game people were talking about. People are still talking about it now. Manchester United 0, Liverpool 5. The fallout continues. It's just endless, really.
Yeah, you'll be shocked to learn that on this podcast feed in the lead up to the game, I said it would be a KG 1-1 draw. Got that completely wrong on our preview show, because that's the way it's felt like those games have always gone. Whatever's going on, however good Liverpool are, however bad Manchester United have been at the time, they always seem to fizzle out into that kind of game and it not be exciting. But Liverpool just blew Manchester United away, and there's a lot of things not right with Manchester United at the moment, but Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is going to find himself under tremendous pressure now, because fans, even those that are really, really loyal to him and appreciate what he's done in his career for Manchester United, they aren't going to tolerate much more of stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, he was already under pressure given what happened midweek in the Champions League against Atalanta, and it felt like the whole narrative of this season for Manchester United is just sort of bailing themselves out of trouble, individuals managing to kind of pull the team up and rescue something, but that only goes so far. And on Sunday, kind of it seemed to unravel in quite spectacular fashion. But there's an interesting piece actually on The Athletic at the moment from Laurie Whitwell and a couple of other writers about the fact that Solskjaer's told he's safe for now, but there is growing discontent and disarray in the dressing room. And that's what happens, I suppose, when you've got a lot of different personalities, a lot of big talents, who some of which have been playing the game for a couple of decades now, have big opinions, have lots of experience, and they're used to being coached a certain way. They used to being coached at all, I think many might argue as well. And there's just a complete lack of direction, really. I mean, some of those goals that they conceded on Sunday were pretty kind of comedy, really, weren't they?
Yeah, it just it feels like there's been a lot of low ebbs since Sir Alex Ferguson departed Manchester United, but this, that probably feels like the lowest one for me. I can't remember anything that was worse than that. And just the dejection around the stadium, the dejection from Solskjaer, the dejection from the players. You kind of feel like, you know, they shouldn't be getting worse at this point. And it really feels like they're on a downward spiral now. And as it turns out, I think you can have too many world-class players in your squad because he can't fit them all in.
And Sancho is one that also a lot of people are frustrated, because in the summer there was this whole song and dance about how much they want. I mean, not even the summer, it's been going on for years, much they wanted Sancho, how important he was, what it took. I mean, The Athletic even did a piece about what it took to persuade him to sign and everything. And obviously we all know he's such a big talent and how important he can be and is already in some ways becoming for England. And no one wants to see a talent like that sort of just fade away on the bench. So I think that adds to it as well, is spending all that money and not even getting to see that player play a part in this season. It's just so negative, isn't it?
And Donny van der Beek.
Yeah.
The guy's played 5 minutes of Premier League football this season. £40 million came with such a high reputation and is a very, very good central midfield player. It's just madness what's happened to him. You don't even talk about him. People don't even think about him, but he's just sat there on that bench week in, week out. There's a lot of stuff that's happened at Manchester United just makes no sense at all. And as I say, if you're not like Manchester United and you don't like wasting money and you want to take advantage of a great offer and read all the great pieces that we've been speaking about, including Laurie's stuff, remember you can sign up today and save 33% on access to the best newsroom in sports. That's just £3.33 a month for an entire year. To do that, just head to theathletic.com/footballpod and you should have that offer ready to go.
People don't want games anymore with nothing at stake. They want, or you're full or you're out, you know. And inside football, we want more games who guarantees income. The future is certainly to find a compromise between what the fans want and enough financial security for what the clubs need.
Jack, welcome to the show. Nice little England reunion podcast for the three of us this morning. Always good to see you. Would you be so kind as to kick things off? The piece that you've done is called What Will the Super League Look Like When It Comes Back? What makes you so sure that it is coming back?
Well, I don't think it's actually gone away. I think Real Madrid, Barcelona and Juventus have spoken publicly about how committed they still are to the idea of a Super League. And so I think really the question is, when will they try it again? But I don't think it's kind of gone anywhere as an idea.
Jack, one of the things I kind of really enjoyed about the piece is the setup is almost like these Super League clubs, especially the ones outside of England, where these sort of like James Bond bad guys kind of looming in the background. Why do you think the English clubs sort of backed out so much when it all kind of kicked off?
I think that's a really important point, is to what extent is there alignment between the big six clubs in England and the sort of three ringleaders, Real Madrid, Barcelona and Juventus? What we saw obviously in April was that the English clubs decided to align themselves with those three teams, and then not all at the same time, but then they all pulled out of that. Now, I think that's kind of for two reasons. One is the public and political backlash in the UK, which I think they completely underestimated. You know, we all saw the fans outside Chelsea, the fans at Old Trafford, the fans at City making themselves very, very clear at how opposed they were to it. And obviously Klopp and Guardiola and Bruno Fernandes and Luke Shaw and lots of people from throughout English football and these big teams came out against it. And then, of course, kind of connected to that, you've got Boris Johnson, who the Super League teams thought they had on side, coming out and saying that he would drop a legislative bomb on the Super League. So those were the reasons why they pulled out. And I think those reasons are still relevant as to why I don't think they will go back in, because they know the fans are against it. They know the UK government's against it. And they're terrified that if they try this again, they will just get hammered publicly. So that's the kind of public political reason for it. On top of that, there's a kind of economic argument here, which is that I think a lot of the Premier League teams have seen how much money they will continue to make from the Premier League through broadcast revenues and commercial revenues. And I think they are moving towards the position of maybe we're better off with the Premier League. Maybe the current situation is actually working out for us. And maybe we don't want to tear everything apart in pursuit of a kind of grass is always greener idea.
Talk of it being James Bond flow, and as soon as I hear that Boris Johnson's involved in something, it feels like it's a bit more despicable me than it would be James Bond, to be honest, with all the minions running around. It was a mess, wasn't it, Jack? The way it came out, we kind of knew it was coming. It broke on that Sunday. I remember it being on Super Sunday, and it all started to come out, and then there was this uproar and a complete backlash. And as you say, it was completely underestimated that what people would say about it. Was that the only reason it failed, though, that backlash?
I think that was the main reason it failed, was that they couldn't sell it. You know, they couldn't sell it. They had no plan to sell it. They had no communications rollout. They had no front man. They had, like, nobody would go on the record to defend it. The only person who would was Florentino Perez, doing that kind of midnight Spanish chat show 2 days down
Love
the
that
line.
Show. Love that show.
So they had no policy to kind of to get people to buy into it, really, which is a total shambles, and shows you how badly handled and badly thought through the whole thing was. When I really think about it, I don't agree with it, but I don't think it's an unsellable idea. I don't think it's impossible to convince people to make these changes, but they just went about it in precisely the wrong, in such a bad way that they didn't get anybody to buy into it at all.
Was it rushed, do you think? Because I presume it would have been like methodically planned. I'm presuming there was a plan of some description. But when it did come out, it did feel very, very hasty and very, very rushed.
Yeah, it was rushed. I think they must have thought quite complacently that they could just bounce everyone into it. You know, we'll put out a press release at midnight on a Sunday, and then everybody will come around to our way of thinking on the Monday, and we'll just do it anyway. Which just goes to show the kind of arrogance of the people who came up with this plan. I mean, somebody made a good point to me that if you look at, like, the biennial World Cup plan...
Yeah,
I was just about to say,
when you look at what FIFA are doing and the advisory groups and the surveys and talking to fans, there is some half method to the madness and the idea, whereas to just rock up one morning, release a press release and say, hey guys, this is what we're doing, with no sort of idea of how it's going to happen, is a little bit stupid.
There was a silly little website, if my memory serves me correctly as well, that looked like it had been knocked up in 5 minutes around the Super League as well. The whole thing was a mess.
Yeah, there was no communications plan at all. I think in part because it was this kind of disparate idea that 12 different clubs had come up with. And nobody wanted to take responsibility for saying, look, I'm going to cop a lot of shit, but I'm going to take the flak and I'm going to go on CNN and BBC and I'm going to sell it to people. Like, look at Arsene Wenger. Like, with whatever you might, as Flo says, whatever you might think about the merits of the biennial World Cup idea, Arsene Wenger is doing the hard yards of being the front man. You know, he's doing the media, he's talking to players, he's talking to managers, he's talking to fans, he's trying to sell this, like, pretty bad idea, I think, but he's trying to sell this bad idea to the world as hard as he can. And nobody would do that with the Super League. You know, John Henry, Joel Glazer, Florentino Perez, Andrea Agnelli, none of these guys would do it.
There is one thing that the clubs did get to sort of squeeze out of UEFA, and that was a new $7 billion emergency relief fund to address some of the cash flow problems that the pandemic caused. And also, going forward, probably a bit more control as well in the Champions League. Do you think that's going to be enough for the English clubs and some of the other clubs that, like PSG, who were opposed to it from the off?
I definitely think that $7 billion fund is hugely important because, you know, as you say, all these clubs are going through a cash flow crisis. The Super League was in small part a reaction to that. And I think a lot of those clubs are going to be thinking, well, if we're not going to do the Super League, then UEFA need to give us some of the things that we would have got through the Super League. Basically, money and control over our competition. So the next big thing, obviously, is going to be the proposed reforms to the Champions League. They've got a bit, you know, that's already started because UEFA have said that team marketing will no longer necessarily be in charge of selling the Champions League, which is going to give clubs probably a little bit more of control over the Champions League marketing process, which is something that they want very much. But if they can, if the Champions League is further reformed in such a way as to give the clubs more kind of permanence and power within it, then I think that is more likely, I think, to make the clubs think, you know what, we're getting enough of what we want through the Premier League, through the official Champions League, that we don't need to pull out and go into a rebel Super League just to get our hands on some more money.
Can you just tell us a bit more about that Champions League reform, Jack? Is there like a date set for when that's going to happen, or a timeline they're looking at for that? Because that will be important with this.
Yeah, so this has been a long process over the last few years that Alexander Šeferin has been heading up. And there were negotiations for this going on at the time of the Super League. So it was initially suspected when the Super League was first talked of in April that this was just a kind of negotiating ploy to get what they wanted out of UEFA. So it does seem as if we are moving towards what people call a Swiss-style model, which I think is probably where it's going to end up, which will mean basically more games for the big teams, which is what they always wanted, harder for them to get knocked out, I imagine, which is also important to them. But I think Šeferin must think that if he turns the Champions League into something that looks more like a Super League, then he can keep the clubs happy.
And for those clubs that are still very keen to make this happen, Real Madrid, Barcelona, Juventus, they are taking UEFA to court about this. Can you tell us a little bit about that court case?
Yeah, so after the Super League was initially paused, there was a case in a court in Madrid, which basically hinges on, does UEFA have the right to punish the Super League clubs, or is UEFA kind of going beyond its jurisdiction in doing so? That's now going to go to the European Court of Justice, who are going to examine this issue. And the key, like, what will be determined here ultimately is whether or not UEFA has the right to oversee and license all club football in Europe, or whether clubs are frankly allowed to do what they want outside of UEFA's jurisdiction. So if the ECJ, I'm kind of crudely summarising here a bit, but if the ECJ finds on the side of the clubs and says, well, actually, UEFA, you can't tell the clubs what to do, the clubs can create their own competition independent of you, then that will give the clubs encouragement to go and set up their own rebel Super League, because frankly, it's not any of UEFA's business.
Is there any inkling yet on how that case may go? I mean, we've seen with the Court of Arbitration for Sport anti-competition things go through there before, in which third parties have defeated international federations when it comes to wanting to run their own competition. I think the example I always look to is the franchise swimming competition that FINA, the International Swimming Federation, tried to block, and eventually they managed to do it. They managed to start this franchise competition.
Joan Laporta spoke about this the other day, and he sounded very confident that he would, you know, that they were on the right track, that the Madrid court had basically found on behalf in agreement with them, and that the ECJ would do the same. I certainly think that, you know, when you listen to, or when you talk with people who are kind of behind the Super League, I think the strongest argument that they have is that UEFA should not be both a regulator and also be operating within the marketplace. You know, UEFA, the argument they make is that, well, UEFA wants to be this kind of independent regulator who oversees all of football in like a neutral and fair way. And yet at the same time, UEFA's putting on the Nations League, it's putting on the Champions League, the Europa League, the Europa Conference League, in which they use the resources of the clubs to make themselves a lot of money. You know, so UEFA makes huge amounts of money from these competitions. If UEFA's ability to do these two things at the same time can be unpicked by the ECJ, then I think at that point it might be a bit of a free-for-all in terms of clubs trying to go their own way and operate outside of UEFA jurisdiction.
You're listening to the Athletic Football Podcast, and we'll hear from Jack after the break on what Super League 2.0 will look like next.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. you can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
We're going to look at everything that we can do with the football authorities to make sure that this doesn't go ahead in the way that it's currently being proposed. I don't think that it is good news for fans. I don't think it's good news for football in this country. And look, don't forget, these clubs are not just great global brands. Of course they're great global brands. They're also clubs that have originated historically from their towns, from their cities, from their local communities. They should have a link with those fans and with the fan base in those communities. So it is very, very important that continues to be the case. I don't like the look of these proposals, and we'll be consulting about what we can do.
Jack, how does the recent Newcastle takeover factor in? Because that feels like the kind of thing that the stereotypical Big Six will not like, a new club emerging with money in the Premier League that could be a contender. Because, you know, in a sense, that again felt like one of the reasons the Super League was coming, because the likes of Arsenal, the likes of Spurs, you know, they were struggling to make the top four season on season.
Yeah, I think that's a really good and important point, is that I think the Super League is best understood not just as the richest clubs in the world trying to seize more power for themselves. It was more a kind of defensive manoeuvre from teams who'd seen PSG, and even though City and Chelsea were involved, but City and Chelsea spent so much money in the last 10, 15 years, transformed the football financial marketplace and start to really undermine the power that what you might call the legacy clubs, you know, Real Madrid, Barcelona, Juventus, Manchester United, and Liverpool, and Arsenal as well, who, you know, Liverpool and Manchester United were definitely the most keen of the English clubs. So Super League is definitely in part a reaction to that kind of oligarch benefactor spending and the effect that it has on the market. And on that basis, you could say that the Saudis buying Newcastle United could encourage the teams to try it again, because they might think, look, we've had this three times now. We've had it with City, Chelsea and PSG. If it's going to happen a fourth time with Newcastle, we need to stop it. We need to pull up the drawbridge before Newcastle can inflate the market so much that our position is undermined. Whether or not in practice that will happen, I've got no idea. But in theory, I can understand why it would be an incentive to do another Super League type thing.
And this 2.0 version, which you touch on in the piece, what do you think it could look like?
So I think if the ECJ ruling goes how Real Madrid, Barcelona and Juventus want it to, and they get encouragement that they can set something else up, I don't think the Premier League clubs would join them, just because I think the Premier League clubs just, you know, I think the politics doesn't work for them anymore. They probably have got more or less what they want. They're getting more of what they want anyway. So then it all could become down to which other clubs could they convince to join. So, you know, there's other clubs in Spain, Italy, you know, the Milan clubs, for example, Atletico Madrid, who I think would be part of it. But then I imagine the next thing they would look at would be bigger clubs from smaller media markets who might think, well, don't have as much power in the marketplace as they might, and who might think, well, actually, you know, the UEFA Champions League isn't really working for us anymore because we're just not making enough money. Now, this is pure speculation on my part, but I think clubs in Scotland could be tempted to look at that. Ukraine, Russia, Turkey, certainly, where there are hugely supportive football clubs. Maybe Holland and Belgium, maybe Portugal. So I think a Super League 2.0 would be, I don't think it would have any teams from France, Germany or England, but I do think it would have a lot of big and well-supported teams from all over Europe in a kind, slightly kind of ragtag, haphazard competition.
But then doesn't that take away from what they were aiming for? Because that doesn't sound glamorous to me. That doesn't sound like something I would
How dare
tune in
you say that about
mid-week.
Celtic and Rangers?
It doesn't. It's not like, you know, if you're watching Manchester United against Bayern Munich, PSG, you're watching all the big teams, you know, you then suddenly get in Real Madrid up against Rangers. it's not got the same appeal. Not being disrespectful, but it just doesn't.
No, that's true. It doesn't. But maybe it would have enough. You know, if they could just have team like willing teams to be group stage fodder, and then quarterfinals and semifinals, which would be Real Madrid, Barcelona, Atletico Madrid, maybe Sevilla, Juventus, the two Milan teams, maybe, I don't know, Zenit, Fenerbahce, Galatasaray, maybe Celtic or Rangers, maybe Benfica, I don't know, maybe Ajax, although I think Ajax are probably a little bit too close to ECA and UEFA to join, but they're exactly the sort of team they would look at. Maybe there would just be enough to have an exciting quarter, semis and final of this kind of Rebel Super League. And if, you know, however they set it up, they would definitely get venture capital pouring in support, and they would sell massive TV deals because people would want to watch the games, and they'd sell tickets for the games. And it would, you know, it wouldn't be the UEFA Champions League, but it wouldn't be nothing either.
Does it not need the Premier League teams, though? Because reading your piece, you state the popularity of the Premier League worldwide, the global appeal that the Premier League brings. If the Premier League teams aren't there, the Super League would lose a lot, in my opinion.
Yeah, it certainly would. It certainly would. And I think the Premier League teams knew this. They were told at the time when they set it up by people who wanted to pull out, who told them, look, you can sink this by pulling out because they need you. That was what was slightly irrational about the Premier League teams joining up in the first place, is that the Super League was a kind of anti-Premier League measure. It was dreamt up in part by Agnelli and Florentino Perez as a way to reduce the financial gap between the Premier League teams and the other big teams in Europe, because they thought it got too far. And so it was not really in the Premier League team's rational interest to join in with this. And so by not joining in with it, the Premier League teams are going to increase the difference between their financial standing and the standing of the other teams. So, yeah, you are absolutely right. It would, if I was Agnelli or Perez or Joao Laporta, I would be desperate to try and get Edward Wood and Joel Glazer on board for any future Super League. But I just don't think the politics work for the English teams.
Let's hear now from The Athletic's Rafa Honigstein on how the Super League 2.0 would be received on the continent.
On the face of it, the big clubs in Germany would really benefit from a Super League. Both Bayern and, to an extent, Dortmund have outgrown the Bundesliga, but they also know that there's politically absolutely no way they can force this through. There is, for all the concern with money and all these things, still a remnant of solidarity and a sense of the greater good. And I think both Bayern and Dortmund are keenly aware that they would effectively, if not destroyed, and certainly damaged the Bundesliga if this was ever to happen, which makes it very, very difficult, if not impossible, to force through. They also have both very, very active members and supporters who would instantly start a backlash. So it's a very, very difficult thing to pull off, even if they wanted to, even if they believed in the project more than they did the first time or the second time around. They can't really force it through on the ground. And that makes it very difficult for everyone else, because the Super League without Germany, the biggest economy in Europe, if not quite the biggest TV market, would immediately lessen the appeal of a Super League. So I think that's one of the reasons why it's unlikely to happen. And the guys that we saw presented last time around, it would have to be very, very open and much closer to the existing format.
And you mentioned your analogy about this potentially ending up looking like the way boxing works, where you've got so many different sort of title and belt holders then all kind of working out when to face each other, and that becomes this $20 million prize or wherever it may be. I guess for boxing fans, they might say, well, why is that such a bad thing? Because it's quite the spectacle. You can make tons of money from hosting these games at big stadiums, and kind of what's not to like about it. But I suppose for a traditional fan, that sounds like the worst idea in the world.
Yeah, it would take a lot of getting used to for football fans, simply because, you know, in the history of football, there's not really, as far as I'm aware, there's not really been anything like, you know, World Series cricket, for example. There's not really been a kind of external challenge to the regulators. And that was what made the Super League such a huge story, is that, you know, no one's really tried to operate outside of FIFA and UEFA before. But if it were to happen, and if this Rebel Super League did exist, But I think fans would get used to it. They'd enjoy the games. People would watch them. They would, you know, buy the TV channels that they were shown on. They'd certainly buy the tickets for the matches themselves. The one thing that would take getting used to would be losing that sense of, well, who is the real European champion? Because we've got, let's say, PSG against Manchester City in the UEFA Champions League final. And then we've got Real Madrid against Juventus in the Rebel Super League final. So we would lose that sense of who the real winner is. But if I was selling it, I'd say it's amazing. You get a whole other competition to enjoy. And one thing that we know about the state of modern football is that people are always happy to pile on more competitions to make more money, and that there is no one, you know, because the footballers are not unionised in any meaningful way, the footballers have got no mechanism to say no. So they will certainly be bounced into playing extra games. Although one thing it could lead to, and again, this is just pure speculation on my part, is that if we did have a official UEFA Champions League and a Rebel Super League operating in parallel, we could have a World Series between the winners of the two competitions at the end of every season. They could play it in Beijing or Riyadh or wherever. You know, that's how I think the World Series started in baseball, because the American League and the National League were two separate parallel competitions, and the World Series was kind of invented as a money spinner between the two best teams. So that's something else to look forward to, I suppose, in a few years' time.
Sounds very Premier League 39th game.
Yeah.
That sounds very, very similar.
PSG against Real Madrid competing for the World Series. So they could do like a 10-match series and have games in, I don't know, Beijing, Melbourne, Shanghai, Riyadh, Dubai, Miami, Buenos Aires, London, Tokyo. It'd be great.
Eddie Hearn's going to get involved, isn't he? It feels like that.
A bit bigger than Eddie Hearn now.
Really? Yeah. It sounds like he's kind of jam. He hasn't got enough going on.
I think Elon Musk is going to put it on.
God, it's going to be played on the moon, apparently. That's why.
That is a different league. There's a different stratosphere.
The Tesla World Series brought to you by God. Elon Musk.
Jeez. The trouble is, I'm laughing, but you know, this stuff isn't impossible.
If you don't laugh, you'll cry, Dan. So
yeah, this stuff isn't impossible at all. I've got a question, Jack, from a subscriber, Paul C. He's raised the point about significant environmental opposition for an additional pan-European pyramid, saying that just when we've seen the first carbon-neutral Premier League game this season, this is just another one of a million obstacles they'll seemingly have to overcome.
Yeah, well, this is a really good point, and this really kind of cuts to this issue of UEFA being a regulator and also in the marketplace, is that you know UEFA talks a good game about carbon neutral and all the rest of it, but UEFA is desperate to pile on more games and competitions to make itself money. You know, whether it's the expanded Euros going to a bigger size, whether it's inventing the Europa Conference League, which nobody frankly was calling for. You know, whether it's inventing the UEFA Nations League, you know, the UEFA are always adding on more games to make itself more money. And obviously, these games come at a huge carbon cost. But because, you know, and if they were being a proper regulator, then maybe they could say, yeah, we're going to have to carbon neutralize all this stuff. But because they're making money out of it, they're just going to pile on the football. And again, it's the same point with the Super League. You know, no one really is going to object to the Super League on carbon, on environmental grounds, because it's not like Agnelli and Joel Glazer and Ed Woodward and Florentino Perez care. Like, they clearly don't care about that at all. And there's no one to make them care. So in that sense, you know, the environmental angle to this just proves what we know already, which is that football is so unregulated that people can do whatever they want to make the most money.
I suppose at this point, Jack, you know, you said at the very start of the podcast that this never went away and it isn't going away. So do we all just have to now accept that it's when, not if, and we're just sort of biding our time until something like this is created?
I think so. Like, I think there will be another push for this. Although, you know, we've had sort of 10, 20 years of football in which people have always said, oh, one day there'll be a Super League, one day they'll try the Super League. And then they tried it and they failed. And so there is an argument, and this is an argument here, I think, probably more in England than abroad, which is that, well, you tried it once, you couldn't pull it off, so why should we listen to you if you're going to threaten it with us again? Maybe, I think that's why I think from an English perspective, I think it's now much less likely that we'll see English teams going off and playing in Super League. So if I was if I supported one of those teams, I do support one of those teams, I'm less worried now about seeing the team that I support go and play Super League games than I would have been in the past. But I do think that it is still likely that Super League will be invented in some form in the next sort of 5 years.
Yeah. Luckily for Flo and myself, it's not something that we have to worry about. Our teams,
you guys have your fun
by any form of Super League. Yeah, doesn't concern us at all. Jack, it's always a pleasure to speak to you. Been great to have you on the show. Thanks ever so much.
Thank you for having me.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
We're still celebrating Black History Month here at The Athletic, so let's highlight another brilliant read from the dedicated collection of articles available on the site right now. Flo?
Yeah, there's actually a really interesting piece on The Athletic at the moment about Gil Heron, who was the first black footballer to play for Celtic. It's a piece by Kieran Devlin, and Kieran's chatted to Gil's granddaughter, who actually lives in the States, about her grandpa and his really interesting story, how he was scouted by Celtic from America. Actually, they were playing a sort of pre-season tournament over in the States. They found him, brought him over, and I think that's probably one of the sort of most interesting and best celebrations within Black History Month, is sort of finding out all these figures and famous, iconic players, whether it's in football or just iconic people in history who kind of been lost in time. And I think it's a really interesting story about someone who actually, you know, is probably really important to the history of Celtic Football Club. But like me, I'm sure lots of people have never really heard of him. And really interesting as well, actually. A massively successful, a creative family, because Gil's son is actually the musician and poet Gil Scott Heron, who is, you know, a really, really famous cultural figure in spoken word and jazz, in especially in Scotland. So yeah, really, really interesting to kind of hear about this family.
The revolution will not be televised.
Yeah, as we say, a host of Black History Month stuff going on The Athletic at the moment. So if you haven't checked that out, go and do so. And if you're not already a subscriber, a reminder that there's a great offer going on at the moment. You can subscribe to The Athletic today for just £3.33 a month. All you got to do is head to theathletic.com/footballpod and you should be able to take advantage of that offer. Nice one, Flo. Thanks to Jack as well for joining us. Always great to talk to him. And of course, thanks to all of you guys for listening as well. Please, please get involved in the comments section. We'd love to hear your thoughts. And wherever you do get your podcasts, if you are enjoying the show, then please leave us a review too. This was the Athletic Football Podcast. Bit of squad rotation. Mark Chapman and Matt Slater will be back with another episode tomorrow. So look out for that and have a great day.
The Athletic.